Accession number 27450, Reel 3.
Bill Maddox, Reel 3. So, you were describing your time at Infal, and do you know when you got there, roughly? Because you set off from the UK in January 45, didn't you?
Yeah, January. I think we got there the end of February.
Right, yeah, uh-huh. And so then you were waiting there.
Yes, we were waiting there for the vehicles.
In, well into yeah. April then.
And
yeah.
in that time, of course, we met a lot of other troops in Imphal.
So who, a lot moving through,
who
I
were
imagine.
Moving through, and some were coming back for a rest, having been in the front fighting the Japanese, who were by then, I suppose, around Mandalay. Waiting for, there was a big battle for Fort Dufferin in Mandalay, and we kept having troops pass through for rest on the way back, and they were full of tales about, you know, what the Japanese were doing and weren't doing.
What did you hear? I mean, did you get an impression of what the Japanese were like?
Yes, of course, we got the impression of their ferocity that they use, and their unwillingness to surrender and take no prisoners, and their cruelty, and the difficulties of jungle fighting, of leeches and all that sort of thing that we later, to some extent, experienced. But it's like everything else. It sounds pretty horrendous when people are relating it to you, but when you experience it, sometimes it's not as bad as you feared.
Mm. What state were some of those troops in?
Some of them were pretty knocked about, yes, and they were very nervous and, I would say, yes, just worn and had enough. But they were pretty strong, really, I suppose, but, you know, some of them were threadbare from the anxiety, I suppose, of being in the front for so long.
How did that make you feel? Did it make you apprehensive?
Well, it made, to some extent, apprehensive, but remember, we were signalled, so with luck, and with our big vehicles, we won't get that close. That was a general feeling. To be honest, selfish, I know, but there you are. At this point, I mean, to some extent, I shouldn't say this, I suppose, but it was a bit like a Boy Scouts camp. We were just there, 25 of us on our own, feeding ourselves. There was a remount depot near us, which had all the mules for taking ammunition and guns up the hills, because, as you may know, they used mainly mules for transport, and in this depot, which was an Indian unit, they had half dozen British officers and about 12 horses, and I don't know, goodness knows how many mules. And one of their officers strolled into our camp and said, "Does anybody here ride?" And I said I could. And he said, "Well, would you like a horse each morning for exercise? Because we've got 12 or more mounts and nobody to exercise them." So for a few days, a few weeks actually, a fresh horse was brought to the tent that I was sleeping in each morning about 6 a.m, and I took this horse and went over the hills in glorious dawn light, because you had to exercise a horse before, say, 8 a.m, before it got too hot. So I had a fresh horse each morning for several weeks. And it was very nice, very comfortable.
And what sort of a horse was it? Was this a sort of local
Indian Army horse. Oh, well trained. And I started to learn one a bit of polo riding while I was there too, which was, I never really got proficient at that, because we moved on just when I was beginning to enjoy it.
Yeah. And what were the mules like? I mean, they're difficult animals.
Lovely. Very docile. I never saw them being maltreated, and I think the muleteers got very affectionate with them. But you see the poor things loaded down with mortars and ammunition, going off up into the hills towards the front, which was some distance away from us. But yes, I think they were very docile, quite affectionate animals, really.
So you stayed there, and people came and people went.
Yeah.
And eventually you got a call.
Eventually we got called. We were. Eventually, of course, our vehicles arrived, and I can't remember, but it must be after May the.
After VE Day.
After VE Day.
Tell me about the VE Day celebrations.
Well, that was. We were still waiting to go forward, and still waiting for our vehicles when they announced the end of the war in Europe. And so Bud Abbott and the rest of us, we thought we ought to have some sort of celebration, so we got the locals to provide either chicken or something for us to eat, and we typed up a menu which looked very grand, but was consisted of course mainly of tin. Everything was out of tins. But it looked effective and it was a suitable impression. And so we all sat around on the ground and ate this celebration lunch for VE Day.
What did you feel about hearing that the war in Europe was over?
I suppose our feeling, what about us out here? I suppose that was our feeling, yes. Nobody seemed to take much notice of what was going on in Burma at that time. May have been just an impression, but... I think some of the fighting troops did feel a certain that they were being neglected. I wouldn't say resent, but they were certainly felt they were being neglected at times. And of course there wasn't much entertainment, and it was after the VE Day that we started to get more ENSA people coming out doing entertaining.
Did you? What, in
Imphal? Yeah, Imphal. And
well, who did you see? Yeah, do you remember?
I think Tommy Trinder was possibly one of them. But there were some very good artists, and it's not fair to say that there was no entertainment, but it was probably... And those that went really worked hard and did a good job. So you have to be careful and not say that nothing was done. But it was probably... fairly sparse, because the nature of Burma, it was difficult to get to. It's not quite like sending a party of entertainers to Europe. Yeah.
Was there an airstrip at Imphal?
Big airstrip, yes. Yeah. And they were using the airstrip. It was not covered, but either side of it there were a lot of smashed up planes and Dakotas, which had been shot up, but the main strip was clear, and they were using it to supply troops in Kuching, you know, the American marauders,
yes,
who were over in on the China border. And they asked for volunteers to go into the Dakotas and help push out supplies, which they dropped by parachute to the marauders. And so chaps that felt inclined went and had a trip in the Dakota and pushed these bales of straw out with the parachute attached. And there's one or two amusing things. I know that while we were languishing in Imphal, one of our chaps was sent on leave. He was long serving, and he was entitled to some leave. So he went back to India, and while he was in India, he got in a bit of trouble with a vehicle or something. I can't remember now. But the result was that he was given 14 days field punishment. That was his award. It wasn't anything terribly serious he did, I must say, but it, anyway, 14 days he... But they couldn't give him 14 days in India because he was on leave and he was due to come back to Imphal, to his unit. So they sent him back to Imphal with this instruction to our officer that he got to award 14 days field punishment. So I mean, the net result of that was that he said, well, what are we going to do with it? He said, I'll tell you what, you make the tea every morning at 6:30 for the next fortnight. So that was his field punishment. But perhaps I should miss.
So tell me about your equipment arriving. It was there. Tell me what they were called again, your transmitters and whatnot.
Transmitters and receivers. They were called pantechnicons. There was a receiver van and a transmitter van drawn by a Bedford vehicle of some kind.
And what was the receiver van like? I mean, this was like
a large caravan, yes. And inside with a row of with two radio receivers and undulators, that's tape machines to receive the signals, and typewriters for us to sit with our headphones on and type the signals. And two keyboards to punch up the tape to transmit. And we all worked in this, we all took turns, shifts, to sit in this caravan and operate.
Right. And what sort of transmitter did you say? It was a SWAB transmitter.
It was a Marconi SWAB 8.
Right.
8 kilowatt transmitter. And that had a van on its own because it was so big. It was like a big, like an enormous wardrobe, metal wardrobe. So you couldn't move that about, but it was very heavy.
Yeah. So when those arrived...
When they arrived, we were all ready to go then, yeah, forward. But of course, by then, we'd missed all our appointments, whatever we were... But we were to have acted as main communications for 14 Army headquarters. But we could never catch them because they were always getting ahead of us. So at this point, we collected all the vehicles together, loaded up, and started going out of Imphal down into Burma. And the first point of call was to be Kalewa, which was at the head of the Chindwin. But again, it was a Burma road, and it was very, very precipitous going down, and we had lots of problems with the two big vehicles, which kept overheating, and we had to keep stopping. And we got to Kalewa, and there was a queue of... I remember when we got onto the Burma road going out of Imphal, the officer in charge of the road, they had a transport officer each time in charge of the section of the road. He said, if those vehicles break down, we'll have to push them over the side because of it's a supply route and we can't block it. So we had to take a chance and we kept going. But when we looked over the edge, you could see lots of... vehicles, tanks and bulldozers, all sorts of things that had gone over the side rather than block the supply route, because it was the main route for the fighting troops. And so we got to Kalewa and to cross the Chinwin, and had to wait there some days while we waited for a pontoon to take us across. And then at that point, when we got across, the vehicles again were in trouble. We kept getting bogged down in mud chowns, you know, in chown is like a muddy sort of river bed, and we had great difficulty in getting the vehicles across them, and we spent much longer than had been intended to make this journey to catch up 14 Army, mainly because of the vehicles, and... We spent nights bivouacked out in the open, and we would stop at night and unroll the what were called outspanners, which are like tents, and would unroll from each vehicle, and then you slept on the ground under these things to keep the rain off you or whatever. So it was a very slow journey.
Did you have trouble with the heat and the humidity, or were you Well, yes, it was
very hot. Yeah. Yes, we were getting down into the valley. The Kabor, the Chinwin, of course, was very, very hot.
Yes.
And it was a misty valley area and extremely humid. Oh, yes, we were very hot then. And
how did you manage that, you know, so health-wise? Were the mosquitoes driving you mad, or... snakes?
Well, they were, yes, or... yes, but we were getting, I suppose, toughened to it by then. Mm. It was... we had mosquito nets, which we sometimes put up at night. But, of course, when we were on the road, there was nowhere to hang them, so we just had to hope for the best, keep your shirt on and just perspire happily or unhappily. And this journey was taking so long that they said we had, amongst other things, apparently, of course we didn't know this at the time, but in the vehicles were some supplies, mainly of paper and stationery, I think, for 14 Army, and they wanted, they sectioned four of us off to go ahead with these supplies and leave the heavy vehicles, which were so slow, and go on ahead on our own. So there was four of us, myself and four signalmen and a corporal, and we were sent off ahead of the others with this equipment, with these paper supplies, which were all in big crates. And we had to make our own way ahead. So the first thing we did was got a lift on a barge taking petrol supplies to 14 Army. So this barge was on the Chinwin, full of 48-gallon tanks of petrol. And, of course, you couldn't technically smoke. It was a highly dangerous operation. But we still had to have hot food, so we still had a little fire at the end of the barge and brewed up tea and all the rest of it, and took our water from the Chinwin River and boiled it to make tea. And we noticed that the driver or the helmsman or whatever he was called, in the local Burmese, who was in charge of the barge, he was smoking cheroots all the time. It didn't seem to worry him. But then began, I suppose, it must have been a week or more's trip down the Chinwin, stopping each night wherever we could find somewhere to stop, either a village or somewhere, an open clearing, because you couldn't navigate at night. So it was really like a trip on a barge in the jungle. It was really quite interesting. And we stopped one or two nights with villages on the edge of the Chinwin, and the locals made us welcome and gave us tea to drink and entertained us.
They were quite friendly.
Quite pleased to see us. Well, they all purported to say they didn't want Japanese, they didn't want any more to do with the Japanese. And this trip, eventually we got to the Irrawaddy, where the Chinwin ran into the Irrawaddy, I think.
Right.
And it was an enormously wide river, the Irrawaddy, extraordinarily wide. And then that was as far as we could go. Then they put us on a coal-burning engine drawing open trucks and took us down the next stage towards Moniwa, I think it was. Uh-huh. Moniwa, Mike Teeler.
Did you have any idea where you were going?
No, we didn't, except our job, our task was to catch 14 army headquarters. And
so they were heading for
Rangoon, pushing the Japanese out, and we were trying to catch them all the time. And I don't know whether the orders changed halfway through, but in the end they settled for four corps headquarters rather than 14 army headquarters, because four corps was fighting down that stretch of the road. And we caught up with them eventually just north of Tongu, I think, and by then the monsoon was coming on, and we were
That's Tongu, T-O-U-N-G.
Yeah, Tongu, right, Tongu, yeah.
Right. So what sort of place was Tongu?
Well, it was dripping wet. I know, it's pouring with rain. And we didn't mix with the locals then. There was no opportunity. We just got to Four Corps headquarters and discharged whatever we had to do, and
were
then
they pleased to see you? I mean, were they waiting for you?
Well, I didn't have a lot to do with that. We sat. I seem to remember all we were concerned was trying to find somewhere dry, and to make a meal, which we did, while the corporal got rid of whatever the equipment we had to get rid of. I can't remember. And then the next thing is we had to try and get on down to Rangoon, which at that point I don't think had fallen, but that was going to be our destination. We had to keep going south, and we got a lift on this coal-burning or wood-burning train with open trucks, and we sat in that, and this train, the sparks were coming out of the engine of this little train, because it was all teak. They were burning teak logs instead of coal. It was sending up great showers of wooden char, as I remember, and it burnt a hole in my kit bag, because they were falling on top of us as we were in open trucks. So that we endured for several miles. Then we got a lift on some supply trucks going south, and but they would only take us as far as Tongu, north of Tongu.
Oh, yeah.
And, somewhere between Tongu, just south of Tongu. Uh-huh. By this time, the Japs were in disarray and were trying to escape across the road from Burma to get to Thailand.
Thailand,
yeah.
Had you seen a Jap by this time?
Only dead ones lying in the river occasionally, yes. And in Mike Tila, they were still, when we stopped at Mike Tila, one of the towns on the way down, the snipers were still in the trees, so we had to be careful. And the Japanese Southern Army was trying to escape into Thailand, and our troops held the road during the day to stop them getting across, to try and trap them. And during the night, we gave way, and the Japs took the road and escaped as well as they could. So the road was... you got as far as you could in daylight, and then they would close the road and say you can't go any further. And that happened with us, and we got caught one night between two sections of the road that were closed, and we had to take refuge in a school building while you could hear shooting going on in the background, and we had to elect one of us to sit up all night as a guard in case we saw any sign of the Japs getting near, but we didn't, so we were lucky. And then, of course, in the morning, lit a fire to make a brew of tea, and Indian troops came running across and said, "You can't have it, no fires are allowed, the Japanese will see us, they're just over the hill." So we had to do without our cup of tea. And then we progressed on further down the road by getting lifts one way and another, and finally we finished up in Rangoon and met and waited for the bigger vehicles. Now, while the big vehicles were still on their way down from northern Burma, that's the wireless vehicle, the receiver and the transmitter, we were given a job to do working with 6th Special Wireless Section, which were intercepting the Japanese and breaking their code, well, and presumably sending it back to GCHQ or Intelligence India.
Right.
And so we worked with them.
This was in Rangoon.
Yes,
yeah.
This was in Rangoon.
Right.
So Japanese were still active north of Rangoon,
right.
You see, with
right.
the Southern Army trying to get across.
Yeah.
We'd taken Rangoon, yeah. But the Japs were still either side of the road.
Yes.
The remnants.
Yeah. So tell me about arriving in Rangoon. What did you see? What did it look like?
Arrived in Rangoon. Well, it was a typical Indian town, really. But full of troops, of course, and we were sent to a wooden bunk tea planter's bungalow, I think it was, in a road called Golden Pagoda Road. I'll always remember that, Golden Pagoda Road, and it had been a nice bungalow before the war, I would imagine, but it was pretty broken down, and the Japs had been in there, and it was. Stuff lying about, and we were billeted there and working with 6th Special Wireless Group, who were
what were they like? I mean, they were differently trained to you, weren't they?
They were trained in they were trained in Morse, and they were put on specialist Morse training for Jap intercepting Jap Morse,
yeah.
And there's a Romanized version of Japanese Morse, and they could interpret it.
Right.
And
what sort of chaps were they? I mean,
did they have
any Japanese language?
Oh, no, they didn't. But they had the Morse expertise, which they'd learned. I mean, they'd been posted there when we were, I suppose, posted to 4 Wireless Group to do automatic Morse.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's just different, a different facet of.
Uh-huh.
But they were nice chaps.
And you worked with them?
And we worked with them.
What did you do?
They did the intercepting, and then it was encoded, whatever they'd intercepted, and we transmitted the coded version to headquarters in India.
Mm-hmm.
And we understand, of course you were working in the dark to some extent, but we understood that the breakdown from the Japanese intercept was quite useful, and in some cases was of immediate benefit if it was intercepting local Japanese active units, and of course for background was of more would be interpreted in the wider sense.
Yes, yeah. So suddenly you're involved in the war.
Yeah, back. Yeah.
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 And travelling to it.
That's right, yes.
Yeah.
And then, of course, in August, when the Japanese surrendered, they surrendered formally in Singapore, but in Burma they went on fighting. They wouldn't surrender, and that was one of the problems. So because by now our transmitter and receivers had arrived, and we were working with them, with 6th Special Wireless using this vans, Mountbatten wanted to use our transmitter, which was the most powerful one available, 8 kilowatts, to break into one of the Japanese wireless circuits to get them to accept the surrender terms. So we had the surrender terms as given by headquarters from Mountbatten.
I'm going to stop you just there, I'm sorry. Bill Maddox, end of reel 3.